This is Marathon Training Academy, episode 71.
Welcome to the Marathon Training Academy podcast. I'm Trevor.
And I'm Angie.
In this episode, we talk with Steve Bourne, a fueling expert from Hammer Nutrition. And for this episode's quick tip, we recommend a technical jacket for running on windy, wintry days. And if you're training for your first marathon or half marathon, find out how to become a member of the Academy by visiting www.marathontrainingacademy.com. So Angie, we just celebrated Thanksgiving here in the United States, and did your overall fitness go down after all that feasting that we did, or what?
I would say no. I mean, I'm pretty diligent about my exercise routine, running, and things like that, but I've definitely eaten too many sweets in the past week or so. I don't like to overeat. I don't like that really full feeling, but I tend to be a snacker, and so, you know, I want to eat something every 3 hours, and if there is sugar in the house, chocolate, I am hard-pressed to stay away from it.
Well, there's been a lot of it around lately. And I hear what you're saying about overeating. I hate that feeling, too, although I still do it.
Sorry to hear that.
So if you do indulge too much on sugar, which happens to be a weakness of yours, do you feel it impact your running? Can you go out and run and be like, oh, I shouldn't have ate so much sugar. I can feel it wearing down on me or something.
Sometimes I feel kind of like a sugar hangover in the morning. It sounds bad, but you know, I kind of like start out the day with a headache, and I just kind of feel like a little bit crabby and crotchety. But usually if I go out and run, then I feel much better afterwards.
Yes.
So how was your run today?
I had a great run. I was able to do a 14-mile training run and looking forward to running the New Orleans Rock and Roll Marathon in February. That is sooner than I really realize, you know.
Well, it'll keep you on track and building up through the holidays, which is always a good thing.
True. You know, marathons are not easy for me. This will be my third marathon I've ever done, and I'm going to be confident about it, train hard, and trust my training, and go into it expecting big things.
Very good. And we're just coming off the Route 66 marathon in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and our next episode will be a recap of that race.
Yes, we had a great time down there in Tulsa. We look forward to filling you in on all the details and telling you about that marathon. It was a really enjoyable event, and I was able to get a PR at my half marathon, so I'm excited about it. Well, in this episode, we're going to play an interview that we recorded with a man who knows a lot about fueling for long-distance running and other endurance sports. His name is Steve Bourne from Hammer Nutrition. Before we get into that, Angie, what is going on out there in the community? Any exciting news going on?
Always. I've got a couple of emails to read from people in the community. The first one says, Angie, I want to let you guys know how inspiring you two are. I've been listening to the backlog of shows for about 2 weeks now and have gained so much knowledge. I ran cross-country in high school with my fastest 5K time in 19 minutes and 58 seconds. I went to college and lived the sedentary lifestyle ever since. I'm a new dad, started working two jobs totaling 70-plus hours per week, and when I got the second job, they required a physical. My doctor had a come-to-Jesus moment with me discussing my current health situation and family history. My blood pressure was 190 over 120. I weighed 255 pounds at 5'10". My doctor looked at me and asked where the hospital bed was. We have a good relationship, so he felt he was able to say that to me no matter how harsh it sounded. I was on the verge of a heart attack, literally. I'm 29 years old, and there was no way I was going on medication. He offered it to me, but said if I didn't take it, I'd have to promise to make incredible lifestyle changes. If I didn't do something, who knows if I'd still be here. I had to change something. I knew I could start running. I'd done it before and had been pretty successful. Not the medal-studded athlete from high school, but I was never the last-place finisher. I figured this had to be my ticket to a healthy lifestyle, plus it didn't really cost anything to do. Heeding advice from a friend, I did get fitted for a pair of shoes at a specialty running shop. I started running back in March by doing a half mile, during which I stopped four times to catch my breath. Then I tried a mile, still stopping several times to catch my breath. Very slowly, I increased the distance I would run. I still remember the first time I completed a full mile without stopping. I am now incredibly proud to say that my farthest run is 15 miles, and I'm signed up for a half marathon. I'm nervous as all get out, and I'm shooting for a 2-hour and 15-minute completion time. We'll see how it goes. Thank you for the inspiration. The listener letters you read during the podcast are my favorite part. Thank you for doing what you do. And that comes from Chris.
Well, that was a really good one. Thank you, Chris, for sending that in. And thank you for listening to our podcast. I'm glad it's been inspirational to you. And I think your story is going to provide inspiration for someone listening to this today.
That's right. No matter where you're at with your health, you can make those positive changes and just turn your health around.
You might get really discouraged if you start out just by trying to run a half mile and you have to, you know, stop 4 times. But that's how a lot of people start.
That's how you started. You started by running for 1 minute and walking for 1 minute and just doing run-walk intervals.
And that was tough. I didn't have the health risks that Chris talked about, but it was still tough for me just to run for 1 mile.
Yeah, you're tearing up the half marathon distance.
No, but if you start out like that, there's no shame. You know, the thing is you just start taking action.
Yeah, we all have to start somewhere.
Even if walking a mile is hard for you at this point, just do it.
That's right. It will get easier. The second email says, here's another MTA success story for you. I've been fit and healthy my entire life, but long distance running always killed my knees. A doctor told me the solution was either to have surgery or stop running, so I gave up on the idea of running any distance longer than a 5K. Then I started practicing yoga several times a week. After about a year of consistent yoga practice, my knee issues disappeared. I started listening to your podcast, and it inspired me to give long distance running another shot. Beginning in January, I started training using your half marathon training plan, and since then I have successfully completed 3 half marathons, and as of this weekend, I'm a finisher of the Marine Corps Marathon. I ran a steady pace, enjoyed the sights, never bonked, thank you Hammer Gels, she says, and finished in 4 hours and 32 minutes. A major lesson I learned from this race was how important it is to discuss with your running partner what you will do if one person starts struggling. I ran with an experienced runner. I think this was marathon number 23 for her, and the only plan we made was what to do if I hit the wall. We never anticipated that she would be the one to struggle on race day. The final 6 miles were a real challenge for both of us, as she kept telling me to leave her behind and I kept refusing. I decided to stay with her until the last 0.5 miles or so. I'm still not sure if this was the right decision. Anyway, I'm now a very proud marathoner. Thank you so much for your podcast and website. You and Trevor do wonderful work offering compassionate, humorous, and informational podcasts. You reignited my passion for running, and you helped me finally accomplish my goal of running a marathon and stay injury-free. Thank you and keep up the great work. And that comes from Minna.
Well, congratulations, Minna, on running your first marathon and doing it injury-free. That's what we're all about.
That's right.
And she mentioned using your half marathon training plan, and we call our plans SMART. Marathon training plans, because Angie's so smart. Now, we think that there are ways to avoid injuries. You know, there's no rock-solid guarantees that you won't get injured if you train for a half marathon or marathon, even with the best techniques. But we're pretty sure there are some really solid ways to avoid injuries that do plague some runners. And we'd like to see every person be in this for the long haul, you know, be able to run when you're 80 years old, right?
That's right.
So what do you think about that? Her friend struggling, and she's, you know, stayed with her until the last 0.5 miles.
Well, I think she brings up a good point that you need to discuss backup plans if you're going to be running with someone. Mm-hmm. And obviously, it doesn't matter who the experienced marathoner is. You need to decide both ways what you'll do if somebody starts struggling. You know, it's definitely not an easy issue. It's an individual choice. So, you know, you don't want to ruin a friendship over a race or anything.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, obviously, if it were me, the experienced marathoner, and you were, you know, not struggling, I would just say, go on, you know. Mm-hmm. And it wouldn't offend me at all if you did. In fact, I'd probably be more annoyed if you stayed with me. But,
you know. If I was the one struggling, you'd be, see ya.
No, when I ran your first marathon with you, I didn't say see ya.
I know. Well, we agreed that you would help me on that.
I was running behind you with a whip in hand.
Well, I wish I could have you run with me in New Orleans, but it's not going to work out.
Not that time.
Well, congratulations to all of you who are reaching new milestones, running your first half marathon or first marathon, or even getting to 3 miles and coming back from a sedentary life to become a runner. That's really exciting, and I think this thing is just spreading, you know, from one person to another, and we're going to have the whole world running someday, right? Because it's just contagious.
Well, they say that bad habits can spread, but good habits can as well.
Yes.
So surround yourself with people who are going where you want to go, and along the way, I know that you'll inspire others as well. Well on my way, well on my way, well on my way.
All right, we're on the podcast today with Steve Bourne. He is a fueling expert at Hammer Nutrition, a company that Angie and I talk about a lot. Steve is also an accomplished athlete holding 2 ultra marathon cycling records and has been inducted into the Ultra Marathon Cycling Hall of Fame. He's the only cyclist in history to complete a double Furnace Creek 508. And Steve has recently been in Australia and New Zealand doing fueling seminars, talking about things that we'll probably talk about on this episode today. Now, Steve has reached the high water mark of his career by coming on the MTA podcast for the second time. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to talk to you both again. Well, thanks for having me back. And I do apologize in advance for my voice. I'm still recuperating from all the talking and all that wonderful recirculated air in the bazillions of airplanes that I was in over the last month or so. So if my voice sounds a little raspy, that's just the way it is.
No problem.
It's God's way of saying, keep your answers brief.
Walk us through your nutrition suggestions for the marathon distance. What would you do, like, let's say the week before, the morning of, and during the race and post race?
Okay, that is a great question. First of all, the week before and the night before, I would not deviate too much, if at all, from what got me there in the first place. And what I mean by that is, I have seen far too many athletes, and I'm guilty as well, that the week leading up to the race, they all of a sudden double or triple their food and water intake, and they salt everything and say, like, hey, I'm a camel. I can store all this and, you know, I'm ready to go. Now, in my opinion, I don't want to deviate a whole lot, if at all, the week before and the night before the race. Because the enzyme that controls glycogen storage is inactive during that time. The week before the race, there's nothing you can do to really enhance your fitness at that time. It's too late. So, you know, if the hay's not in the barn fitness-wise, there's nothing you can really do to improve the quality of your fitness. But you can sure throw a monkey wrench in your race by training leading up to race day. So you should be resting. And the same thing is true with your fueling. Why deviate from what got you there by all of a sudden, you know, just drastically increasing your food and fluid consumption? Your body's going, you know, we were doing just great. And now all of a sudden you're just, you know, throwing a monkey wrench in this whole thing. What do you want me to do with everything?
Right.
So people tend to overcompensate. So the enzyme that controls glycogen storage, muscle glycogen being the first fuel that your body is going to use when the race begins, that enzyme is only active during a very short time frame after a workout. So to me, true carbo loading is not what you do the week before the race or the night before the race. It's what you do in the 0 to 60 minutes after all of your workouts leading up to the race. That's when your body is most receptive to taking your carbohydrate intake, converting it into glycogen, storing it in the liver and muscles, and that's how you build up those reserves. So, you know, the week before the race, the night before the race, all that excess food you're eating is not going to help you. So that should cover the week before and the night before. The morning of the race, well, that's an interesting topic because we wrote an article about pre-exercise, pre-race fueling has by far generated the most skepticism. Here's the premise of it. It sounds a little, you know, out of the box, but it physiologically speaking, it makes perfect sense. Muscle glycogen, which took you many, many weeks of hard training and post-workout refueling, ASAP, after your workout, that's the first fuel your body's going to tap into when you begin a race. the fitter you become and the more consistent you are with post-workout refueling, your body can store somewhere between 60 to 90 minutes worth of this premium fuel. Some say a little bit more than that. Now, the morning of the race, if you eat too close to the start of the race, say 1 to 2 hours prior, you will burn through or deplete those hard-earned stores of muscle glycogen at a much more rapid rate. You will just deplete those in record time. Instead, we recommend fasting for 3 hours prior, before the start of the race. That allows insulin and all of its hormonal influences to go back down to baseline. That's what you want. That allows your body to be in a state where it utilizes those finite, hard-earned stores of glycogen most efficiently. Now, some people say, well, wait a minute, I've got a 7 a.m. race start. Do I need to get up at 2 o'clock just to eat? And the answer is no, because interestingly, if you go to bed with 60 to 90 minutes of glycogen stored in the muscles, that is exactly what you're going to wake up with. You haven't drained one calorie of that, even after a full night's sleep. So even though your brain is going, I'm hungry, feed me, and your stomach's growling, your muscles are actually going, hey, we're good to go. So you can start the race on an empty stomach, believe it or not. And in 13 years of working with athletes, everyone who has applied that no eating for 3 hours prior to the start of a race, and I'm talking about races that are longer than 60 to 90 minutes, anything shorter than that, that rule doesn't apply. But every single athlete who has faithfully applied the no eating, no calories, for 3 hours prior to the start of the race, every single one of them has said, you know, I thought that was crazy, but I just had the best race of my life. And it's simply because your body is using its stores of glycogen more efficiently. So you don't need to sacrifice sleep to eat. I would much rather get all the benefits of a good full night's sleep. If you happen to just wake up to go to the bathroom and you feel like, okay, maybe I'll just top things off, that's fine. But don't sacrifice sleep to eat. It's not necessary. If you have an early morning race start and you don't have a comfortable 3-hour window in which to finish a meal prior to the start of the race, it's probably better, well, we believe it's better, to have a little something, say a banana, a serving of Hammer Gel, about 5 to 8 minutes prior to the race. By the time those calories are ingested and blood sugar levels are elevated, the race has long since begun, and you won't have negatively affected how your body is utilizing those hard-earned finite stores of muscle glycogen. So the morning of the race, you have three options. If you have a comfortable 3-hour window in which to finish a small meal and you only need 200 to 400 calories tops, you don't need the 2,000 calorie mega meal, 200 to 400 calories tops, if you can finish it comfortably within 3 hours of the start of your warm-up and race, go for it. If that's not an option and you're just jonesing for something to eat prior to the race, 1 to 200 calories of super easily digested fuel like Hammer Gel or a banana or something similar, 5 to 8 minutes prior to the start of the race, that's a good strategy. Or just begin the race on an empty stomach and begin refueling shortly after you feel comfortable. I'm a bike rider, so for me it takes about 20 minutes before my body says muscles are feeling good. Stomach is giving me signals, okay, ready to take on fuel. As long as I don't wait too long to start refueling the refueling process, I'm fine. So it's either 3 hours prior, 5 to 8 minutes prior, or shortly after you begin the race. If people will do that, they will see unbelievable results in the quality of their performance and how long it takes them before they start fatiguing. Like everything else, it's a learned, acquired skill, so it does take a little practice. I don't recommend going cold turkey. Gradually wean yourself off of eating before the start of your longer workouts and races, and watch how your body responds. It's amazing.
Let me just say, Angie and I have done that now for probably, you know, half dozen races, and now we wouldn't think of doing a race any other way.
Yeah, it really, really works. And so I used to have blood sugar crashes, you know, during the race because of eating at the wrong times, and just going into it with an empty stomach and having a hammer gel right before the start is just really revolutionized my experience. So definitely what you're saying is true.
Yeah, it sounds really counterintuitive, especially after you've slept for 8 hours or whatever, and, you know, you wake up and your brain is going, hey, the tank's on empty. It's not. You know, the first fuel your body is going to use is still there in full amount. You haven't lost any of it, even after a full night's sleep. Now, during the race, it really depends on the duration of the race. You know, if you're in that 3 to 3.5 hour range, I think carbs only, you know, just carrying hammer gel and drinking water and using Endurolytes to take care of your electrolytic mineral needs, you know, hammer gel for calories, water for hydration, Endurolytes for electrolytes, that's all you need for a 3 to 3.5 hour race. Will you be producing a little fatigue-causing ammonia? Yes. But by the time that really becomes problematic, race is long done. Now, if you're going to be out there for 4, 5 hours or more, you're going to want to have a little protein in your fuel mix to help prevent your body from tearing down the lean muscle tissue to make energy. So that's where a fuel like Sustain Energy or Perpetuum comes in. And post-race, you gotta refill the tank. And this is, I'm so zealous about post-workout and post-race refueling. You know, that's your way of telling your body, I understand that I've just put the wood to you, that I've drained you, and, you know, your immune system can go in the toilet or it can get stronger. Your lean muscle tissue can get stronger or it can just take forever to repair. And if you don't, you know, do it as soon as possible, you won't be able to store glycogen more efficiently. So that's where Recoverite comes in. Absolutely. As soon as possible, ideally within the first 30 to 60 minutes after all your workouts and definitely after the race. Then go in and enjoy your post-race comfort food.
That sounds excellent. I was excited to see that Hammer has some new vegan products in its lineup. So can you tell us what products you have that are vegan-friendly now?
Well, vegan-friendly, meaning foods and fuels that are free of meat, fish, and dairy products, all of our products, with the exception of the Hammer Whey Protein and Recoverate, which is a whey protein-based recovery drink, are vegan-friendly. We are coming out with a Hammer Vegan Protein that contains 5 different types of vegan-friendly protein, pea protein, organic brown rice protein, organic spirulina, organic chlorella, and alfalfa. All of those are good vegan-friendly food choices. I've tasted them. They're delicious. I don't have an ETA when they're coming out. I'm hoping early next year. Vanilla, chocolate, and strawberry. We also have 2 new vegan recovery bars. Guys, I can never pronounce this. One is a cacao flavored, you know, kind of a cocoa flavored. Mm-hmm. And the other one is a chocolate peanut butter. And those contain pea protein and organic rice protein.
So would both of those be a friendly source of protein for someone with a soy allergy?
Exactly. That's exactly why we did that. As you noticed, you know, in the Hammer Vegan Protein, the powdered form, at least part of the reason why we introduced that and the bars is, you know, are for people that can't tolerate soy or who have soy allergies. So I'm glad you reminded me of that, because that's part of the reason and a very big part of the reason why those products are being introduced. I haven't told anyone this because I don't know if it can be done, but I am currently tinkering with a vegetarian, vegan-friendly joint health product. Typically, most of the joint health products have glucosamine and chondroitin. Both glucosamine and chondroitin come from animal sources, but I believe there are non-animal sources available, When that happens, I have no idea, but that's something I'm looking into as well. So we're definitely looking into, you know, more vegan-friendly products as well, and products, as you said, that are going to be suitable for people that have soy intolerances or allergies.
That sounds excellent. Great.
I have the next question. The term hitting the wall gets thrown around a lot. What exactly is going on in your body when you bonk or hit the wall, and how can a runner avoid it?
Well, bonk is usually described as the depletion of the glycogen from your muscles and liver. You know, glycogen, you know, from the muscles is the primary fuel source at the beginning of exercise, and then as you exercise, the glycogen that is produced by your exogenous or your fuel donation, that provides the other fuel source. So bonking or hitting the wall is simply what happens when you run out of gas, when your glycogen is depleted. So that's basically the description or the definition of that. Can you avoid it? Absolutely. The number one thing you can do, and again, this goes back to the thing I'm most zealous about, is post-workout refueling. If more athletes would do that, honest to gosh, I believe that people would see better performances in their, I think they'd see better athletic performances, greater endurance. I also believe they would see better immune system functioning. They'd be able to increase their training volume and intensity without their muscular system or their immune system, you know, taking such a beating. And all you have to do is refill the tank with high quality food or a high quality recovery drink like Recoverite within the first 30 to 60 minutes. That's that window of time when that enzyme that controls glycogen storage is most active. So when the workout is done, the workout's not done. So before you get out of the sweaty clothes, and before you get in the shower, and before you get horizontal for a couple hours and take a nap, you've got to refill the tank. If you do that, as your body becomes more adapted to the stress you're putting it on training, it rewards you. Your immune system gets stronger. Your lean muscle tissue builds stronger. And you store more and more minutes of glycogen in the muscles, up to 60 to 90 minutes worth. You can avoid bonking, especially in these shorter races, by having that reservoir of muscle glycogen available. And it's so darn easy. All you have to do is train and put some food or fuel back in your body ASAP after workouts. That's the number one thing. Number two, you've got to eat a diet that has adequate amounts of quality carbohydrates. The actual percentages vary, but I think somewhere around 60 to 65% carbohydrates, good quality carbohydrates, is important. And you need to consume fuel during training. You've just got to replenish your fuel during training. That's how you prevent bonking from happening. And of course, you know, if you're not prepared, you know, if you haven't trained properly, you know, the too much too soon syndrome, I mean, If I were to try and run a marathon on little training, there's not a darn thing in the world that's going to keep me from suffering mildly, let alone bonking. So, you know, the training component obviously comes in. You've got to train adequately. But nutritionally speaking, the best things you can do are, you know, post-workout refueling. That is the most important thing. If more athletes did that, honest to gosh, we'd see athletes having better quality workouts. I really believe we'd see more athletes having personal bests in their races, and they'd have a lot more fun doing it. And of course, you know, the diet has to be adequate in carbohydrates, and you've got to consume an adequate amount of fuel during training and racing. Speaking of the latter, we believe that fueling, and at least in terms of calories, is not how much can I stuff down my gullet before I get sick. Forget about replacing, you know, what you're burning with, you know, X out with X or near X back in. The body is not designed to do that. Never has been, never will be. The body has a limited capability of accepting digesting and returning to the energy cycle calories. It has a very limited amount that it can do that. It can maybe accept, digest, and return to the energy cycle about a third of what it's losing. So it always begs the question, well, if you're telling me I'm burning 500, 600, 700, 800 calories an hour and I can only replace that with at the most a third of that, what keeps me from bonking or dying? Well, you know, first of all, well, the main reason is because we have a mechanism called body fat stores. And once you hit hour number two and beyond, two-thirds of your energy will be fulfilled from body fat stores. After, say, 90 minutes, 2 hours, they take care of about two-thirds of your energy requirements. They're the body's fuel of choice. And, in fact, I believe that when athletes overdo it on the calories, the body responds by saying, look, I had literally tens of thousands of calories, literally tens of thousands of calories that I was willing to donate to the cause. But if you want to do it all on your own, fine. I can't help you, and you're on your own. So when you consume too many calories during exercise, trying to replace X out with X or near X back in, your body, you know, you're actually shooting yourself in the foot. You're not doing your body any favors. So our belief in fueling is not how many calories can I get away with before I get sick, but rather what's the least amount of calories I need to consume to keep my body doing what I want it to do hour after hour after hour. What's the least amount? And if I err on the not enough side, that's a lot easier, less painful, less time costly way, you know, problem to fix than a, I overdid it on the calories. Now my stomach is starting to growl and I feel it coming back up. So I'm not telling athletes to deprive themselves of calories, but I'm telling them to work in cooperation with this body fat, you know, mechanism that allows your body to bridge the gap between what it's losing and what it can comfortably accept in return from you.
Awesome. This next question is from Sydney, and she says, should your fueling hydration protocol change if you're a salty sweater?
Well, first of all, again, that goes back to biological predisposition. Some people just have high fluid loss, high sodium loss rates. But you got to remember that when we start exercise, thanks to the average American diet, we are storing somewhere between 8 to 10,000 milligrams of sodium. So we are overdoing it on the sodium. So the first thing to do is to cut back on the sodium in your diet. The original recommended daily allowance was 2,300 milligrams a day. The American Heart Association last year lowered that to 1,500 milligrams per day. I cannot tell you how difficult it is to get down to that, but the lower you can keep your sodium intake during the diet, the lower your sweat loss is going to be during exercise, unless you happen to be one of these people that just have a unique biological predisposition that causes you to be a salty sweater. All that being said, some salt stains on the body and clothing are to be expected as you're losing those minerals and salt and the sweat evaporates. You're going to see some salt stains. That's natural and it's normal. I mean, but if you start looking like, you know, Lot's wife, like this pillar of salt, that usually means that your sodium from your salt intake from your diet is too high. But yeah, if you are a salty sweater, first thing to do is take a look at your diet and make sure that it's, you know, you lower the obvious sodium things, the processed foods and things like that. You can get plenty of sodium to maintain optimal health from unprocessed natural raw foods. The nice thing with Endurolite is it has, unlike a lot of other products, it has 100 milligrams of salt, you know, 40 milligrams of sodium, 60 milligrams of chloride. That's what makes up salt. That's what it has on a per capsule basis. So if you are a salty sweater, yeah, maybe, especially if you've addressed the diet, maybe your salt and electrolyte needs go up. Your hydration may need to go up, especially if it's on a hot day. But, you know, I think when you see excess salt on the body, that's not your body's way of saying, I need more. I think that's the body's way of saying, I'm getting rid of the excess.
That's good to know.
You know, the average, I haven't looked at the figures lately, but from my best recollection, every man, woman, and child, and we're talking about everyone over the age of two, every man, woman, and child in America is consuming somewhere in the realm of 6,000 to 8,000 milligrams of sodium per day. I mean, that is that. I mean, that's like at least four times the amount that we need.
Mm-hmm.
And the body is very adept at storing sodium in the tissues, so we have a huge reservoir ready to serve us. And if you are a heavy sweater and have a high sodium diet, yeah, you're going to exhibit a lot of salt on your clothing and on your skin. Now, some of that is going to be expected as the sweat evaporates, but if your diet's too high in salt, your body is simply getting rid of the excess. It's not really saying, I need more. So, but the nice thing with Endurolytes is that it is a low to moderate sodium, and it's not just a salt tablet. What's really nice with Endurolytes is that it balances, responsibly balances all of the minerals, all of the positively charged ions, all of the negatively charged ions. It blends them together, and when the cells of the muscle cells have a blend of all the minerals versus one mineral, you know, when you overdo it on one mineral, when the muscle cells have a blend of all the minerals, that cell will work more efficiently and produce energy more effectively rather than when it's overdosed on any one mineral or another. That's why athletes run into problems. It's one of the many reasons athletes run into problems when they, you know, overdo it on the sodium. So excess sweat does not necessarily mean the body is wanting more sodium. Basically, it's saying, I'm just getting rid of the excess. And again, with Endurolytes, because it's moderately dosed on a per capsule basis, you don't have to worry about ODing on that.
Sounds good. This next question is from Julie. She says, when you're running a half or full marathon, should you have a set fueling plan or just take your gel or fuel whenever your body feels like it?
Great question, Julie. Here's my belief on that. I always want to have a fueling plan, something that I've tested in training under a variety of conditions. I want to go into that race knowing that I have tested my fueling plan, and I know under a variety of conditions that this is what works for Steve Bourne.
Mm-hmm.
That will allow me to go into the competition going, well, you know, I have something in place, and I don't have to guess. You know, far too many athletes go into a race thinking, you know, well, I'll just kind of wing it and see how it goes. And they're the ones that are usually, you know, off the side of the road, bent over, you know, hurling or whatever. So it is a good idea to have a fueling plan that you've tested thoroughly in training. But I have that fueling plan. When I get to a race, that fueling plan is written in pencil, not in ink, meaning that come race day, I am not going to be a slave to that plan. I am going to be willing to be flexible with that plan in deference to the weather, race nerves, which always diminish. I mean, long before the race starts, my stomach's in knots, which, you know, long before I hit the starting line, my stomach's already in knots. I just get nervous, and that diminishes your ability to digest calories. Increased pace will oftentimes diminish your ability to process calories. If the weather is hot, that will diminish your ability to process calories. So you need to be willing, you need to have a good fueling plan that you've tested thoroughly in training, but just as important, you have to be willing to alter that in deference to the weather, race nerves, the terrain, and whatever else the race is throwing at you. So have a game plan, but write it in pencil, not in ink.
Good advice. This Next question is from Bill. He says, as a health-conscious runner, we are taught whole food is best. How do supplements fit into this plan? Are they considered highly processed?
Great questions, Bill. Diet always comes first. Always, always, always. Supplements mean just that. They supplement the diet. So whole food, high-quality diet is first and foremost. However, there is an ever-growing body of research that shows that even the best of diets, especially for athletes, are not making the grade when it comes to even preventing a deficiency disease. In other words, there are an awful lot of diets that are so low in certain vitamins and minerals that they are below what is required to prevent a deficiency disease. So forget about, you know, optimal health. So supplements help bridge the gap between what you're getting in your diet, which again is the first and foremost thing you need to focus on. But supplements do bridge the gap between what you're getting in your diet or what you should be getting in your diet and what you're actually getting. Mm-hmm. Certain antioxidants are very unavailable in the diet. You'd have to eat a ton of certain foods to get enough coenzyme Q10. Highly unlikely that you'd be getting enough. So supplements, you know, help do that, you know, replacing what the diet can't provide. But say for a multivitamin, its role is simply to bridge the gap between what we should be getting from our diet versus what we're actually getting. Are they considered highly processed? I am going to quote one of my favorite nutritionists. I don't always agree with them, but I love what he writes about this. It's Dr. Michael Colgan. I think everyone's heard about him. He has a chapter in his book, Optimum Sports Nutritionist. It goes way back, but this is still true. He has a little section in his book that's entitled, There Are No Natural Vitamins. And he says, one of the most frequent questions asked on our nutrition hotline concerns natural versus synthetic vitamins. Because the word natural sells, many supplement makers use it in their advertising and product labels. But the pill ingredients themselves are about as natural as a polyester suit. All vitamins, I love that. All vitamins today are predominantly synthetic. That is, they are pure chemicals created out of a food base. Most vitamin C, for example, is made from corn. First, the corn is chemically converted to sugar and crystallized. Then it is chemically converted to pure synthetic ascorbic acid. There is not a molecule of natural corn left in it. So the body, with the exception of two vitamins, vitamin E and vitamin K, the body does not recognize the difference between synthetic versus natural. I will go to the nth degree to argue that with anyone. The body does not know the difference, with the exception of vitamin E and vitamin K in terms of absorption rates. The body knows no difference between so-called natural vitamins, which really aren't, according to Colgan, versus, you know, synthetic vitamins. They're basically chemicals. So don't spend your money on vitamins that say they're all natural. Now, what vitamins do not provide are the myriad phytochemicals that comes from whole food. I mean, you know, what you're getting is the vitamin. In the whole food, you're getting all of these wonderful phytochemicals that are indigenous to these whole foods. That's what's missing from vitamin supplements. So that's why the diet comes first, because you may not be getting the full amount of vitamins that you need, but what you are getting are all of these occur only in vegetable nutrients that you just can't get out of a vitamin pill. Vegetables and fruits have literally tens to hundreds to thousands of phytochemicals that occur only in those fruits. So when you take a vitamin supplement, that's all you're getting is the vitamin. And that's why I think whole foods are the best strategy, along with augmenting that with a multivitamin supplement, because Whole Foods gives you all of these wonderful phytonutrients. I mean, you look at, you know, all of the things like raspberries and strawberries. They have all of these compounds in there that are found only in those fruits. Broccoli and certain cruciferous vegetables have all sorts of phytochemicals that are found only in those vegetables. So you've got to eat the whole foods to get those phytochemicals, but because they are usually nutrient poor in terms of vitamins and minerals, a good multivitamin is a good way to bridge the gap. And again, there are some nutrients that are just almost impossible to get from foods, things like coenzyme Q10, which is a wonderful cardiovascular health nutrient, has some athletic performance benefits attached to it, probably one of the best things you can take to help with the prevention of heart-related conditions. So, you know, supplements have their place, but they never, ever, ever take the place of whole food.
That's great. Our last question is kind of related to diet as well. It comes from a couple of listeners, Angie and Rick. They say, what are your thoughts on the paleo diet? Is there really something to this diet craze, or is it just that? And along the lines of paleo, what are your ideas of ketosis and running on our fat stores as opposed to running our body on carbs?
Well, I think the paleo diet, what I know about it, and I don't claim to be an expert on it, I do think it's a healthy diet. There's a lot of work going on now that shows that an all-vegetarian diet actually is a healthier diet in terms of preventing cardiovascular disease. I mean, you put 10, you know, nutritional scientists in a room, you're going to probably come out with 10 different ideas. I think for the endurance athlete, the paleo diet may not be the best in terms of replenishing carbohydrate stores. So I don't think it's a bad diet, but for the endurance athlete, I'm not sure that this is the most ideal diet. Again, there's a lot of research out there on a plant-based diet being the ideal diet for optimal health. So I'm one of these, I'm a meatitarian, you know? I'm going to have my meat once in a while, but I always make sure I include, you know, lots of cruciferous vegetables and you know, leafy green vegetables, spinach and things like that. I love orange and red and yellow bell peppers, you know, and nuts. I think nuts are so important. I mean, you want to get some really healthy essential fatty acids, eat nuts. I mean, walnuts are just phenomenal sources of magnesium and healthy fats. So, but I'm going off track here. So I'm not an expert on the paleo diet. I do think from what I've read, it's a healthy diet. I also think that what I've been reading about the vegetarian diet, it seems to be gaining more ground as being an ideal diet for optimal health. We need, as far as, you know, the whole thing of ketosis and running on our fat stores as opposed to running our bodies on carbs, look, you need the carbohydrates, at least a certain amount of them, to allow the body fat stores to be used as energy more efficiently. That's kind of the match that lights the fire so that the body fat stores can be used efficiently. And again, once you hit hour number two and beyond, as a natural process of the body, up to two-thirds of your body fat stores, or more appropriately stated, the calories from your body fat stores, after about 2 hours, they're going to be, you know, the body's fuel of choice. But you still need carbohydrates. You know, the carbohydrates are important for a number of reasons, one of which is that they kind of ignite the fire so that body fats can be used more effectively in the energy cycle. So I hope I answered that question to Angie and Rick's satisfaction.
Yeah, I think that makes sense.
So, Steve, after a long weekend, has anybody come to work and say, man, I am hammered?
I do it every weekend, especially when my Oregon Ducks pound the living crap out of Arizona State and yet get dropped in the BCS rankings. I don't get it. So, A lot of people here still race. I'm officially retired from racing, but a lot of people still race. And with cyclocross season coming in to vogue here, and we have a couple of really good ultra-distance runners here, you know, they come in after a race, and, yeah, they're hammered. So.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking time to answer these questions, and you really threw down the content, Steve, and I appreciate that. And we're just big supporters of Hammer Nutrition, and I don't think we'll ever be able to run a long training run or a marathon without you guys in our pockets. So.
Well, we really appreciate it, and thank you for having me on your show again today, and let's do it again.
All right. Well, hope you get lots of rest after all that jet lag coming back from the future there in New Zealand.
I'm planning on it. It's slowly but surely coming back.
Great.
Awesome. Have a great day.
All right. Take care. Have a great week, you guys.
Thanks
again.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Steve Bourne. And usually when we talk to him, he does most of the talking.
He's a wealth of information, that's for sure.
Yeah, we just ask him the question, and it's like winding him up and let him go, you know? Well, you can definitely tell he's passionate about this topic. And when you're passionate about your job and you can really put your whole self into it, it really helps in life, don't you think?
That's right.
So now it's time for this episode's quick tip. And we're going to tell you about a technical running jacket that Angie and I have been using. Actually, we got these jackets at the Screaming Pumpkin Marathon, which we talked about in episode number 70. And these things are really slick. I mean, I've really enjoyed owning this jacket. And a couple times I've been out running in the cold and the wind, I've been so thankful for it. So we thought, man, let's recommend this thing.
It's one of those pieces of gear that you think, what did I do before I had this?
Yeah, I was just thinking that today. Because it was really chilly this morning, like down in the 30s. And I'm like, well, how did I do this last year? What was I wearing?
The jacket is called the Saucony Kinvara jacket. And it's, you know, it's really great for a windbreaking layer, but it also has breathable panels along the side so that it doesn't trap all the sweat on your body. It's great pockets.
Really lightweight.
Lightweight, some reflective details. It's a little bit longer in the back, so you don't have the cold wind blowing up your back.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it's a great jacket. I told you the other day it was worth doing the race just for that jacket that we got.
Literally, because they are like $100 jackets.
Exactly.
So it is a bit pricey, but I think that if you know, shell out the money to buy one, you won't regret it.
Hey, and Christmas is coming up, so throw it on your Christmas list. Ours are bright orange, like construction worker orange.
Yes.
Which is great for visibility during running. But you found that wearing it like downtown, you get a lot of attention.
I walked in the bank with it on one time. People were like, whoa, you know, who's this guy?
Put on the sunglasses.
Yeah. But it's kind of cool because it kind of makes me look fit, the jacket, you know, because it's really close fitting and makes me look really trim. And
you are very trim.
Oh, thanks. Well, I look even trimmer with it on. You look like an athlete, like you're part of the Olympic team or something. Like that's what they wear when they go into banks.
Okay.
So anyway, that's the Saucony Kinvara jacket. You don't have to get bright orange. I suppose it comes in different colors.
Yes. In fact, I haven't seen the bright orange anywhere else, so I don't know if it was kind of a specialty order for that particular race or what, but...
But we like it, and we think you'll probably like it, too.
That's right.
And if you'd like more information on running and marathon training, please visit us at marathontrainingacademy.com. And when you are on our website, you can download a free audio gift called The 7 Pillars of Successful Marathon Training, as well as join our email list and get updates and training tips. Thank you for listening. We want you to remember that you do have what it takes to run a marathon and change your life. Well on my way, well on my